The White Network presents The Heretic's Hour with Carolyn Yeager.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you for joining me, Carolyn Yeager, on this 29th day of July 2013. Already 29th day of July. We're on the other side of the year of 2013 and working our way down to the end of it. Tonight I'm feeling a little bit, I wouldn't say weary, probably a little overly relaxed maybe. So this is going to be a kind of a low key show, I think, but I have some things I want to say, and I'm going to be holding forth on queers and Jews. That, as far as I know, two groups that I consider big problems for us and that irritate me a lot when I come in contact with what they're doing. And the Jewish problem, though, is far worse than the other problem and far worse than anything else we face. But it's behind some of these others, and they are also irritants and problems. It's not just that things are irritating to me, but I see the signs. You know, I see what it's all leading to and what the intention is. I feel that we need to have better ideas about what we can do, what individual people can do. And that's what I'm going to be trying to focus on tonight. I didn't send a mailer out for this show. Once in a while I don't. And I knew already this morning I wasn't going to do it. I had spent all day yesterday finishing up the new article at Elie Wiesel Kahn's The World, which is called Elie's Adventures in Buchenland. That's been hanging over me for a long time, that I knew I was going to write it, and I had promised it in a sense, and I was but I had so many other things to do, and it was something that I was really hard to do. You know, that's really creative writing. I couldn't depend on anything else to you know, use to bring it together. So, but I finally got going on it, and I worked quite a few days and worked a lot of hours for that thing. And you wouldn't know it, because it, you know, it should seem as though it was just something kind of jotted down, you know, in a moment of having fun. But there's a lot that goes into something like that. For me, it does, and probably for everyone who writes things like that. But I hope that you will go and take a look at it. I'm satisfied for now, and I don't intend to be doing a series like this or doing another one, because it requires a lot of going into the revisionist material and making sure that you include some things and include them in the right way and all of that. So It's probably a one of a kind for the moment, and I hope that people enjoy it. So after finishing that late yesterday, getting it up there, it takes a while after I've got it written to format it on the WordPress site for Elie Wiesel Kahn's The World. It usually takes me, I always forget how long it takes to do that. Things don't go right, and I have to figure out how to fix them and so on, and I don't have that many choices there. So I ended up working all day yesterday, even though I thought I was done with it, and I was just going to post it. But every time I go through it, I see something to change, some little edits. I'm editing and editing. Anyway, I haven't done anything to it today, so I completed everything yesterday. So I've been looking around at the news and looking for a few other items to add to what I already had that I wanted to talk about tonight. And one of these things is that our language is being taken over. You know, when I see not only that word, turning to the homosexual problem, not only the word gay, which most all of you listening to me right now and by far the most of you who will listen to this program understand the offensiveness of the word gay, and that we don't really like to use it, but the media uses it, and for a very good reason, in order to lighten it up and make it seem not offensive. But they have, it's well known, it's been commented on quite a bit, how they've taken the word gay and taken it so that we can't use it. It's no longer of any use. It can be used in the old sense of, lighthearted and happy and so on, that it always had. But people don't seem to want to use it anymore. And the other thing is the way it covers up the practice that is being described by the people who are called gay. So the other thing, though, that I came to my mind is I keep seeing these pictures of when there's anything about homosexual rights, being taken another step forward and so on. You have this, they usually include, and in these great gay pride parades, they include these rainbow color flags and rainbow color banners, and everywhere is the rainbow colors. Now, how have they been able to steal the rainbow for themselves? I know it started with multiculturalism. It started with, some of the black organizations calling themselves the Rainbow Coalition and so on. And they were sort of using images of the rainbow. But now the gay community, the homosexual community has really taken it over big time. And everything you see, it's about homosexuality. You see those, the beautiful colors, the beautiful color spectrum, and it represents them. It's really a terrible thing. And this is the way things have been going for a long time now, since others, not ourselves, have been on the upswing. And as they have been on the upswing, we have lost more and more without fully realizing it or acting upon it or doing anything about it. So we lose a little bit, and we lose a little bit, but that's a lot to lose. If you have any other ideas about what we've lost, you are free to call into this program in the second hour, and the number is 1-833-443-4911. That's after our break. I always want to say the first break, but it's the only break in the second hour. So going back to the homosexuals, all right, Pope Francis was in the news this morning, and he was on some kind of an overseas trip. Now, I don't like this Pope. I never cared that much about Popes. They didn't matter to me who the Pope was. But now it's become an issue, how the Pope behaves and so on, since the church has become so much under the influence of Judaism and also now going along with every kind of liberal deal that comes along, and so fast, and now the Catholic Church has been one of the mainstays against homosexuality, but now Pope Francis has made these remarks that they've made a lot out of, but they might not, I have said this before, and I do really believe that the media tries to interpret what anybody says, and in as much a light as is what they are after, their own agenda, the Jewish agenda, you might say, and in this case, the queer agenda, which the Jews are behind, and the black agenda, which the Jews support also. So they try to make it sound as much in favor of that, of those areas, of those ideas as possible. They think that's good. We should probably do that. We should talk instead of quite so much doom and gloom, and I may be speaking to myself here, should maybe be more, you know, take everything on a more positive note. So let's see what I can do with this. Because he said, this is the quote, "If a person is gay, seeks God, and has goodwill, who am I to judge? They should not be marginalized." So I thought that was pretty shocking, because it sounded like he's saying, well, there is, you know, we don't have anything against homosexuals in our church, and if in our church community, and in our parishioners and so on. If it's up to God, well, what he's saying here, and he's right about this at least, he's not saying, "I am God and I will decide." He is saying, he's being very humble here. Who am I to judge? That basically that God judges, and if this person is sincere and is looking for God, and they're gay, that it's not for the church to kick them out. Well, it so happens that that the church has always kind of had this policy that the they have something called the church catechism. It says that when a gay person that a gay person can be accepted and should be accepted, but not if they're acting out on homosexual acts. And as far as homosexuals in the church, like in the priesthood and higher, they are called to chastity. They are not to be carrying out sodomy amongst themselves and so on. But you see, this is all just words, because there's no chastity. Naturally, you're going to find some individuals who do practice that. But as we know, with all these scandals and so on. And then that may, again, be another case where they play that up beyond the numbers that are really participating in that. But we know that that there is that priests and others are acting out their homosexuality. And sex is so, everything is so sexualized, so that people are looking for ways to express sex in the way they want to express it in some way and not get in trouble with it. I think mainly they're looking to do that. And so what I understood, even from back when I was younger, quite a bit younger, that in the seminaries, those who were called to be priests and who were in training in the seminaries, there was a lot of homosexuality going on. Although I had a cousin who was doing that. He had always been real, not very masculine, and they thought the best thing for him was to, they knew that he was to make him a priest. See, that's what they do. And he didn't last all that long. Before he was out of seminary, he had left. And I'm pretty sure it was that they had recommended that he leave, that he was asked to leave. And maybe because he was acting out his homosexuality, and that was disapproved of. So I'm not saying that it just goes on and nobody cares and it's just some kind of wild orgy going on, in seminaries. It obviously is not. So if you're doing that and they think that you're not going to be able to control it, then they don't want you. There's just a lot of anger that comes up when we keep reading all these things. And of course, but again, the media loves to play it up. They love to play it up and get people like me, you know, worked up over it and up unhappy over it. And that's part of the game, and that's part of the they love to torture people too. The Jews do. So how should we respond to this? Well, I think it's important to not participate. I don't mean not to participate in queerness, because if you're not queer, you're not going to. But if you are, if you do have those tendencies and you are a white nationalist, you should pull yourself together and pull out some character and not think that you can combine the things and look for arguments for why that can be done. And that goes on, there have been some good discussions about this here and there. I think that's why I'm on the side of being, of not tolerating homosexuality. That's my position. That in a movement like white nationalism or in just when we are trying to reclaim something or to hold on to, what is ours and to reclaim it because we've lost too much of it. We can't afford to give in to impulses that are going to weaken us. And people who say that that these homosexuals can be good, you know, they're good white pro-white people, and they can fit in and so on. I don't. The way that homosexuality is being used today, and is being so out front, so everybody coming out in these horrible parades and homosexual marriages and all of that, I don't think that it's possible. So my position is to totally say no to it. And for that, to talk about that a little bit, I'm going to go over to look at Countercurrents' front page at Countercurrents. Publishing.com. And you know, today on the Daily, was it yesterday or the day before on the Daily Stormer, there was an article written by one of the writers there on, but it had the title Sodomite in it. And it was, it had the position that I take on there. And there are some people writing, comments to it and saying that that they like this site Countercurrents, and this has been true of many people in the white movement all along, that they like Countercurrents. They think it has this great intellectual flavor to it. It has a lot of good articles, they say, and a lot of good writing, and these are, you know, if these people are really pro-white and even if they're homosexual, well, let them let them do their thing. Well, you've got then all these people going and looking at that. And I hadn't, you know, I used to have a lot to say about them, but I hadn't talked about it for quite a while, try to stay off that subject. But I went and looked at their front page today. And the current lineup of articles is practically, and that it goes down quite a ways. You scroll down quite a ways. It's practically 100% by homosexual writers. That's how it's changed. It may have been all along. I didn't know who they were, but I'm pretty convinced of which ones are homosexual and which ones aren't. So I'm gonna go through this list and talk about it a little bit, because the first one on there, the newest post on there, is dated July 29th. And its title is The Fall of the Southern Avenger. It's by Gregory Hood. Well, I am convinced and have been for a long time that Gregory Hood is queer. Now, how do I, do I know him? No. Have I written to him? Has he told me? have I looked at his, you know, who he hangs out with or anything? No. But I look at the writing, the style of writing, and the subject matter. And I think you can tell a lot from there, and just the fact that he's on that site, which doesn't, you know, I'm not just going by that, but the fact that he's been on there for quite a long time, and these are all pseudonyms. I don't believe, I'm sure his name, whoever was writing this, doesn't really have the name Gregory Hood. Johnson uses his real name. Greg Johnson uses his real name, and he has intimated in the past that when he was just starting out in white nationalism, in a sense, he was asked to, I don't know exactly the progress, but he got involved with the Occidental Quarterly magazine, which is, you know, a white nationalist magazine, or pro-white magazine, very well known. And under Kevin MacDonald, not the Occidental Observer, which is MacDonald's blog and online kind of magazine, but this is a real magazine. And then he was asked to be the editor, and he had to use his real name. He said that he would not have used his real name, and he wishes he wasn't using his real name. But he had to be editor, and he wanted to be editor. So, and he had some problems with various things, and he was asked to resign after a couple of years. Some of it was the money he was spending for things that he wasn't supposed to spend it on. But then he was already out, and also he continued with his real name. But I think most of these writers there don't, except for a couple of them, which I'll mention. But Gregory Hood is a regular on there. You know, he especially is movie reviews, and he writes reviews on, he has something on the Lone Ranger movie, the Superman movie, the latest one, White House Down, all these ones with kind of heroes and good-looking men type, very male heroes, and lots of eye candy flicks. You know, there are these movies where there's lots of eye candy for males, for homosexuals. And it's all, he always writes about men and men only. It's always about, these kind of things. Now at, the next post there, July 29th, Greg Johnson is the author of this, and it's called The Nigger Word. And he also, says there that, he talks about his site, and he says, at countercurrents/North American New Right, our aim is to raise the social status, intellectual rigor, and stylistic tone of racial discourse. And so, you know, he is on that site. They have like they give themselves two different sites, or two different two different names, and in a sense programs that they've got going. One is the Countercurrents Publishing, and the other is North American New Right, which is, I guess, more of their editorial type belief system that they're pushing along. So he's very much taken hold of that North American New Right. So we've got that New Right idea. The New Right has always been heavy with homosexuals. It was the British New Right. And there might be a European New Right, which never got quite so big, but the British New Right, I don't know if that's what they called it, was going very strong, and I think still is. And they are heavy on homosexuals. So Johnson, we know Greg Johnson is homosexual. He used to try to pretend like he wasn't, and he used to be real coy about it, and he'd get on forums and answer questions and charge things back and forth, you know, argue back and forth. He never would answer. So silly. You know, he never would answer a direct question about it. But there's no longer any question. Nobody has any question about it. And he doesn't try to, get out, pretend like he's not anymore. In fact, there's something that he said. Wonder where I have that. I might have that way down here. Yeah. Well, he wrote, he had two articles in a row about gay marriage at the beginning of the end of June, beginning of July. And in one of them, he was talking about the homosexual side of an argument, and he used the word us, referring to it. He said, you know, if you're going to, those of you who are arguing against gay marriage or whatever, you're not being fair to us about something. He used that word us in such a way, I was going to get that from where I had, I could find it, but I don't want to go look at it, go look for it right now. But he did say that. He did use the word us, including himself, thus, in with the gay crowd. So on July 28th, they had a the next one down is Principles of Convenience by Jack Donovan. Now, Jack Donovan has written for them quite a bit. I talked about him in the past. He's very much out about being queer, and he's never, ever denied it. He's proud of it. He writes about it, and he's been writing for Countercurrents for and Friends with Greg for a long time. Plus, he's the one who had a couple of interviews at Voice of Reason Radio, and he is the one who is... The first time I heard that was shortly after, I don't know, not too shortly, but sometime after I had started doing a radio program there. So now we're talking about 2010, and I was listening to Tom Sunick's Tuesday night show, which, you know, as it was just being broadcast, and he had this guest, Jack Donovan, who I never heard of, and he's talking away, and finally, it becomes plain, and he says it right out that he is gay, and finally, Tom Sunick says this kind of realizes it, and he obviously didn't know it. I don't think he was putting on an act, and he says, "Well, he says what you're saying here. I don't remember how he phrased it, but he made it kind of clear that that this wasn't going to be accepted very well by the audience listening, and that he didn't accept it very well himself. Tom Sunick didn't. And I sent a Skype message to Mike Connor at the time, and I said, "Hey, this guest of Tom's is a homosexual," and I was shocked, you know. And what I got back from Mike was he kind of, you know, laughed, and I laughed it off like, "Oh, really? Oh gosh, that Tom Sunick or something." He's that, you know, I think that, that this friendship between the Countercurrents people and the Voice of Reason people was more, let's say they knew more about each other than met the eye at the time, and that they knew what they were getting into with that site. And so I don't know if I'll go into any of that later, but I really am very hesitant to do any, to start saying things about people for no good reason. And if there isn't any good reason, I shouldn't do it. So then on July 26th, the next one down, is Andrew Hamilton, another pseudonym of a person who's been writing on Countercurrents for a pretty long time, too. Of course, Countercurrents is only 2.5 years old, if that, or something like that. So it's not like we're talking about a long time. But he's been there, and you see his name a lot. And this one is titled Rudyard Kipling's The Burden of Jerusalem. And I didn't read it, but Andrew Hamilton also talks a lot about movies. And there's just all kinds of movie talk on Countercurrents. And that's another field that homosexuals really get into and really like. And they particularly like the good-looking young heroes in the movies. And they like the relationship between the older and younger men. And they like all that stuff. And they like the superheroes and everything that's all these muscular types and so on. They really get into it, and you find that most of the movies that are reviewed and talked about on Countercurrents are this type and have these type of actors in them. And they really get into it. Now, the next one is another homosexual, Jonathan Bowden, on July 26th. He had Jonathan Bowden writing about Jonathan Bowden, the late Jonathan Bowden. He is no longer living. He died, time goes by, a year and a half ago or something. He died suddenly. Nobody knew he was queer. Nobody thought, most people didn't think he was queer, but it's pretty, I realized that at some point after he died because of the way that Greg Johnson was writing about him. And then I saw a video of him where he just looked it so much. And then I started paying more attention and I realized that he was. That's why Greg Johnson was extremely fond of him. And I think they had something going on. Why not? When Bowden came to the United States, to San Francisco, to attend seminar, whatever they were, kind of group meetings that Johnson put on. And there were a couple for the Occidental Quarterly that Bowden had been asked to come and speak at. And Greg Johnson was his host for those meetings, and Bowden stayed at his apartment. And I think that's when they started something up, and Johnson was really impressed with Bowden, not just, I think also intellectually and so on, but he now features Bowden as though, you know, he's somebody, he almost treats him like he's part, you know, like he's worshiping in a shrine. There's all this Jonathan Bowden stuff at Countercurrents, as though he's one of the greatest intellectuals and white pro-white people that ever lived, and that's how he puts a lot of stuff by him on there. So then going to July 25th, we've got this woman, Julie Howard Hobson, who often goes to this, not often, but once in a while, writes something. And this one is, she has a book of poems. I don't know if it's her book or somebody else's book of poetry that she's reviewing, but it's about the Bader-Meinhof group in Germany, the far left group. And she is someone who is kind of a nature, back to nature person, gardener type person. And she's one of the few females who seems to get along there with all those homosexuals there. And so once in a while, if she has something, they put that up, because I believe they like to have a few women. They don't want a lot of them, but a few, to show that they're not just all men there. And there are certain type of women who are not at all sexualized, you know, not at all sex. There's nothing sexy about them. They're either old or they're just, you know, not there. I think this woman is married and might have a family. Now, July 25th, we have more Jonathan Bowden, but this time it's a review of his book. He wrote a book called Pulp Fascism, and it's reviewed by Ted Salas, S-A-L-L-I-S. Now, I don't know much about Ted Salas, but I was looking him up. And he's done a study, or is doing a study ongoing, or has finished it, I don't know, of Marvel comic book characters. Marvel Comics characters, and a lot of his stuff is pulp type. Yeah, is that kind of pop fiction and pop comics and so on that he writes about. So, and he's reviewing Jonathan Bowden's book. You know, I would just say he's also queer. I'm sure he is. You know, I mean, how does he get into all this with these people? And this book was edited by Greg Johnson. So Ted is just writing a review of it for them. Now we have on July 23rd another article by Greg Johnson. And this is titled The Psychology of Apostasy. And, you know, all these things have a, they're presented as being very, I don't know what the right word to use. Like they're, you have to have a lot of, you know, they're about people who most people don't know of, and, they're about subjects that you have to have, you know, go into history or into literature and so on to know about, and things, you know, presenting it in this way that this is really intellectual, high-level stuff, although mostly when you read it, you find out it isn't. But the photograph here that's used, there's a, you know, they have nice, as I've said before, Countercurrents is very good-looking, and they have nice nice pictures with everything. And this one is a picture of a young naked martyr tied to a tree. And this is so typical. I mean, he's, you know, he looks like he's, you know, like it's very similar to someone who is in sexual play and is being tied up, you know, and now only has his, he's naked, and now somebody's going to come and, you know, kind of, you know, playfully torment him, or maybe not so playfully or whatever. But anyway, and he's quite young and good looking, that good looking, fag looking face, you know, that good looking homosexual, handsome face on this, in this picture, which is really a religious picture of a martyr. But, anyway, that's, they like those things there. And then, July 22nd, we have, they're selling Jonathan Bowden's book. It says now in print, Jonathan Bowden's Pulp Fascism. Then on July 22nd, new release date, they're pushing Savitri Devi's The Lightning in the Sun. This is they've been selling that book all along, but this is the third edition they've put together. They put together a new third edition. It looks like a new cover. And again, they have her, they like having her as their female presence, even more so than this Julie Howard Hobson, because Savitri Devi is dead, and she was old. She got old before she got very famous, and she's just the perfect kind of female for them. She was never sexual at all. She was born in Britain. She lived and grew up in France or something. But she married an Indian man. She was always a rebel and pushing against the conventions of the day. And she married an Indian man, so that would make her a race mixer. But it said that they never consummated the marriage sexually, and she never had children. She was an intellectual who was writing all the time and a big fan of National Socialism and Adolf Hitler. And so that's she's also into, kind of paganism and Indian religion, but of the higher type. So, she fits all those things. She was not Christian, but she was, and being a big fan of Hitler and National Socialism gives them that connection. They, at Countercurrents, they like to have that connection to Hitler and National Socialism and fascism, of course. But they don't want to, they cannot endorse Adolf Hitler and his party's views anymore because they were anti-homosexual, you know? And they put homosexuals in concentration camps. And Gray Johnson has even written about that. And he's against that. And he doesn't like straight up Nazism, which is what he might call it. He might call it that. But if they can come around it, you know, from get in touch with it from a kind of an indirect way, a little more indirect way, they're very happy with that. Now we come on also on July 20th to Matt Parrott, who has been writing for Countercurrents. He joined Countercurrents after the fall of Voice of Reason, and Countercurrents was going to take over all that radio and all those radio hosts, and then also develop their own radio, but that didn't, and Matt Parrott was put in charge of it. Now, Matt Parrott was on again, off again at Voice of Reason with Mike Connor. Yeah, he was doing a show, and all of a sudden wasn't showing up for it anymore. And then he started another one, and then he wouldn't show up for that. And even when he got on with Mike Connor on the Friday show that they started, which was pretty popular because Friday shows of that nature always are. I wish we could have a Friday show at the White Network, but it hasn't worked out. So guess we never will. But even that, he then, you know, didn't show up and conked out on that. And then he was coming on real strong there at Countercurrents, and I'm wondering why is he doing there with all those queers? And he's even conked out on that. I mean, that whole radio thing that he was supposed to be in charge of never got going. And his own programs don't. Even his writings he just does once in a while. So I don't know what his problem is, but I'm going to come out and say that I think he's homosexual, too. I do think so. And I only think so, you know. I don't have any proof, but I'm going to say it because, you know, circumstantially, it all fits. It's all circumstantial. And I think I'm going to pass on going into all the circumstances because, really, that's just not very nice of me to do. But I felt I had to say that because I'm making this list of all the how everybody at Countercurrents, or just about, is queer, and I think he is too. Now, the thing is, he's married, but he married a woman who had children, and all his children that he calls his children, not a one of them is his, unless maybe, you know, there's one, he's gonna have one, but so far as far as I know, they haven't. So he wanted to be a family man, but he didn't want to, but he doesn't have his own family, really. He's taken on this woman's family, and she's quite a bit older than him. So what kind of a deal is this? Well, that's just speculation going into that. But you know, you can't say, well, he's married and has kids, because it's not quite that way. Now, on July 19th, we've got Gregory Hood again. I already talked about him. This is Waking Up from the American Dream, Not Our Victory. It's about the Zimmerman case. But I'm absolutely sure Gregory Hood is homosexual. And, you know, since I've been saying these things, nobody has come along that I know of. Nobody's brought it to my attention. I don't read the comments there. They were closed for a while, but they're open again now, I guess. Nobody's come along and said, oh, you're wrong about that person. I'm waiting for, you know, you can, I will get on here and I will apologize profusely if I'm wrong. But nobody's told me that. The Psychology of a Turncoat is by Andrew Hamilton. See, there's another, him again. See, here, we're going to come into the same people over and again, because it's only a certain amount who write here, basically. And I have already said that I think he is. This one is about Derek Black. And in the picture that they choose to show of Derek Black, he looks super gay in this picture of Derek Black. Now, there's some speculation whether he is gay. And that's why he's turned and, you know, turned away from the white nationalist movement in the way that he did. This is the son of Don Black. Most of you are familiar with that, I imagine. Well, you know, that's just... I did not read all these. I couldn't read them all, but I did look through a couple of them. Now, July 19th, same date as this one about Derek Black, we have something from Michael O'Meara, Arms and Being. Now, I don't know. It's probably something old, because Michael O'Meara doesn't write for Countercurrents anymore, and a lot of the posts that are very attractive looking and all on Countercurrents are what would you call it? You know, repeats. They're just things that are taken that somebody has written. They take this or that part, some essay, some chapter from a book or part of a chapter. They just take something from that these people have, the author has written, and they make a post out of it. And, but I looked around at Michael O'Meara, and I'm going to say he's probably not homosexual. You know, I am not sure, but I'm not going to say that he is because I don't have that feeling about him from his writing that he necessarily is. So we give Michael O'Meara a pass. Though I understand he used to be pretty well connected over there, and then he quit. But maybe it was for that reason that he quit. I don't know. But we'll pass on that. July 16th, Savitri Devi again. They just love Savitri Devi. This one is Akhenaten on racial diversity. See, they just go through her writings, and they pick out something, and they turn it into a blog post. It's not anything new. And they do that a lot there. I could do that. I could put a lot of posts at carolynyeager.net and of this and that from here and there. But I don't do it because, one, it takes time to even do that, which I don't have much time. And then I don't have any big reason to do it. You know, I don't have any, I think, well, people can read it somewhere else. Well, I don't know. See, I'm just not trying to have a certain look. I like to feel like this is something I really want to put up here rather than just try to make a showy-looking site. Now, July 15th, Greg Johnson has written something again, but he's written something about three writers, two of which are Carl Schmidt and Rene Guénon, who are some of his favorites. In another one, I don't know, Iliad. But we know Greg Johnson is queer. And then we have Matt Parrott again, Warlords with the Wi-Fi from July 15th. I did read this back at that time when I was looking the place over again. And, it wasn't much. I think he kind of took it from somewhere and made some comments about something, but kind of short. And then we have somebody named Ofa Whiteson, Untainted Love. I'd never seen her name there before, O-F-F-A, Ofa Whiteson. And I looked it all over, but you know what? It turns out that this is another one of those things where they don't know her. I mean, I don't know if they know her, but they just took this article from a website called wodensfolk.org UK. It's about sexual, it's a pagan type site. And this one is about sexual mysticism, this article of hers that they posted. And she talks about the Kali Yuga. She talks about the Wheel of Time as it's turning, and that the Avatar is expected to appear at some point. And we are in the end times, the days of the Kali Yuga, foretold centuries ago. And she talks about Ragnarok and Vishnu Purana and all of this stuff. I used to really get into this stuff myself. So it's not like I'm ignorant about it or I, you know, don't appreciate it. I used to appreciate it quite a bit, but I'm not interested in it anymore. And I think you pass this because this is, to me, she writes here, passion will be the sole bond of union between sexes during the Kali Yuga, and women will be the objects merely of sensual gratification. These are the times we're living through now. Blah, blah. This is the Indian passive attitude toward life. That we're in these cycles of time, there's nothing we can do about it. You know, we're in the Kali Yuga time. It's going to get even worse before finally it's going to end. It's like predestination. You know, and it's going to end, and the great newborn time is going to come up, and we won't. All this stuff is going to be ended, and we're going to be in a brand new cycle. And then move into the golden age of that and so on. So what we do is we just endure. I don't think this is the attitude that we should have. And it's not the Western attitude. And there's a difference in, those people who are attracted to this, well, fine. When you're You know, everybody probably is at some time in their life, if they're a reader and a searcher and so on. But, you know, the Western attitude to me is best exemplified for us by none other than Adolf Hitler. Sorry to have to keep coming back to this man, but there just isn't anybody any better. And you struggle and you fight. You don't just say, well, we're in the Kali Yuga and this is the way it is now. This woman also cites D.H. Lawrence as the model for brilliance and good thinking and so on, and I cannot agree with that at all, so I don't think I care for her. But that's the type of woman that they like there. Now, July 12th, they have All or Nothing, The Prisoner and Ibsen's Brand. This is by Colin Cleary. I've seen Colin Cleary there quite a bit, and I looked over all of his, you know, some of his articles there to see what he was writing about. And I say he's probably queer. He's basically pagan. Would go along with this woman here, Ofa Whiteson. He's a master in the Rune Guild. His essays have appeared in TYR and Runa. So, you know, he's into all that old, I'm not putting this stuff down. I know, I'm not, but I can't say it really speaks to me. And while I was interested in all of this at one time and I tried to learn about it, it just didn't grab me, truthfully. So, this is his background, this Colin Cleary, but mainly his reviews. He reviews theatrical productions. Now, that's a giveaway, too. The queers love theater, just love it. And, of course, movies and all of that. And they're, you probably, if you got into that line of work, you would be surrounded by them. And you would, you know, you better get along. You'd have to get along with them because they would be pretty dominant there, along with Jews. In this article, All or Nothing, about Ibsen's The Prisoner and Ibsen's Brand, the play Brand, it's about Patrick McGoohan, the actor. You know, he's that good-looking British actor, and they have a bunch of pictures of him in this article, where he looks, this Patrick McGoohan looks queer himself because he's got that look, you know, that good-looking, handsome look and very dramatic and so on. And so, you know, it's all about love of and for handsome men. That's what it's all about, you know, and loving the beautiful male body and good-looking men and just indulging in it. They're so much indulging in this at Countercurrents. And that's why it's done, because their success comes from, I'm sure it has to, they're very successful at Countercurrents in two ways. They have a lot of traffic, and he collects a lot of money. He really pulls in the money. And because homosexuals have a lot of money, there's all kinds of wealthy homosexuals. Well, they're in the arts and theater and in Hollywood and in, you know, all that kind of thing. And they support him. So that's why he never could and he never would reject that and try to, you know, he's come out more and more because it's in his interest. He's just given up, I think, Greg Johnson has, on trying to pretend and not have to talk about it or whatever. He's still not really talking about it, but, you know, the site speaks for itself. So let's go on to another one on June 12th is, actually it's an essay by Carl Schmidt. Now that's another, like the woman Savitri Devi, that they really like Carl Schmidt because he wrote, he was kind of a National Socialist, writer. He wrote about it. He was kind of previous to that. He's considered one of the, I suppose, philosophers, forerunners of the whole movement. He wasn't involved with Adolf Hitler himself, as far as I know. He just talked about the theories and so on. And that's another way, like I say, they like to get into all that, but they want to stay away from direct contact with too much of what Adolf Hitler was really all about. They're not comfortable with that because it's anti-homo. So they did another essay by Carl Schmitt. They just post these things, and I found out later that it's Carl Schmitt's birthday or something, and that's why they do that. That's another thing they do when any of these people that they like, or any like even Nietzsche or anybody like that has an anniversary of some sort, then they'll play that up and run a bunch of stuff about them. And they have on July 11th, they have three things by Carl Schmitt all July 11th and 12th. And then they have just Julie Howard Hobson again. And Greg Johnson writes Remembering Carl Schmitt on July 11th. He writes about Carl Schmitt. And more Carl Schmitt. And then Gregory Hood, movie review. More queer stuff. And I mean, anyone reading this site is, in my opinion, and I think you people need to understand this, that if you're enjoying this site, you are fully accepting and adapting yourself to the homosexual scene, to their philosophy, their lifestyle, their choices, their preferences, etc. It's not a neutral intellectual ground for anyone. It's not just white nationalist intellectual from an intellectual position or something. It's fully and completely homosexual. And so I think people need to be aware of that, and they should not indulge in that if they're not homosexual. Okay, be back in 5 minutes, ladies and gentlemen.
Sie liegen im Westen und Osten, sie liegen in aller Welt, und ihre Helme verrosten und Kreuz und Hügel zerfällt. Sie liegen verscharrt und versunken im Massengrab und im Meer, aber es leben Halunken und die ziehen noch über sie her. Heute tobt mit frechem Gebaren man durch Blätte und Lüge und Glanz. Sie fielen mit 18 Jahren in einem anderen Tanz. Heute tobt mit frechem Gebaren man durch Blätte und Lüge und Glanz. Sie fielen mit 18 Jahren in einem anderen Tanz. Sie waren nicht ausgezogen um Beute und schnöden Gewinn. Was heute verlacht und verlogen, es hatte für sie einen Sinn. Sie hatten ihr junges Leben nicht weniger lieb als die. Heute Höhnen es hinzugeben, sei reine Idiotie. Heute macht man mit funkelnden Wagen und Dünkel und Mammon starrt. Sie starben an vielen Tagen noch hinterm Stacheldraht. Heute macht man mit funkelnden Wagen und Dünkel und Mammon starrt. Sie starben an vielen Tagen noch hinterm Stacheldraht. Thank you. demonstrieren, mehr Freizeit bei höherem Lohn. Sie mussten ins Feld marschieren, der Vater, der Bruder, der Sohn. Sie gingen die Heimat zu schützen und haben allen entsagt. Was kann uns der Einsatz nützen, hat keiner von ihnen gefragt. Sie haben ihr Leben und Sterben dem Vaterland geweiht und wussten nicht, welchen Herben und welche Erbärmlichkeit. Sie haben ihr Leben und Sterben dem Vaterland geweiht und wussten nicht, welchen Herben und welche Erbärmlichkeit und welche Erbärmlichkeit.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. And this is Carolyn Yeager on the Heretics Hour on July 29th, 2013. I spent a long time on that, talking about all those authors on that, all those posts on this Countercurrent site in the first hour. Maybe a little bit too long, but I want to emphasize that I think we need to be more discriminating in what we take in. I think what we take into our systems, what we take into our mind through reading, just like what we take into our bodies through eating and so on, you know, it makes us who we are. And we may be missing out. We may be depriving ourselves of a lot that would really be good for us if we weren't spending time with things that are not good for us. So one thing that I want to comment, oh, I forgot now what it was. I was going to say something when I first got back, but I can't seem to bring it up to my mind. So I'll just go on and say that I want to talk about Holocaust now, Holocaust and Jews, in this second hour. And also, as I said, you're welcome to call in if you want to discuss any of this, 1-830-443-4911. Something that really upset me, or, you know, kind of got to me just the other day, was this story about this bell in Austria. Because it's just the typical kind of thing that they do. This bell that was discovered when a... What was it, a castle? Let's see, a castle of wolf passing in Austria was sold. It was the property of the Austrian government, and they sold it, or it has been sold. It says it has been sold. And then when this was going on, it was discovered that the property included a bell in some tower there that has the word Adolf Hitler inscribed on it. His name is on it, and it's a nice looking, I have a picture of the bell here, and, you know, it's in old Gothic lettering, and it says a bunch of stuff, and then in larger letters, Adolf Hitler, and then it says some more German words, all put on this. This bell is probably, what do they make bells out of? Cast iron or something. And now they're all in a flutter over the fact that somebody's going to have this Hitler bell, this bell with Hitler's name on it, and they don't want anybody to have it. And you know, when I say they're all in a flutter, if you see these stories, and they're always put out by Jews. Now, who put out this story? Where is it? Well, AP. I don't know. I don't have it. Who put the story out? But it might have been a Jewish, or it might have been British, but the British media. But it turns out it's a senior official of Vienna's Jewish community. See, no, the Austrians do not hate Adolf Hitler, and they don't have this idea that everything has to be destroyed, and they don't have this fear of it or any of that. And if things just go on, and this has been there all these years in this castle, but now it's come to be known, and and again, Vienna. Didn't I tell? I've told you. Everything comes from Vienna in Austria. That all the Jews in Austria just about live in Vienna, which is nice for the rest of the Austrians. They don't have to have all those Jews. Maybe there's, you know, a few here and there, but they don't have all those Jews all in the rest of Austria, and they don't want them. But in Vienna, there's a large Jewish community, and they are very active. And this guy's name is Fastenbauer. They always have. They have the German names. They have the Austrian names. You know, they act in Austria like they're just Austrians. Why do they act like that there? We're Austrians. But, of course, they're running these. They represent the Jewish community and the Jewish community's interests. And so he says, I think the best thing would be if the bell disappeared and was buried somewhere. Can you imagine? They have to bury that bell because it's probably difficult to destroy, and maybe he does not quite doesn't have the courage to say he wants to destroy it because it sounds so much like what they say the Nazis did, you know. And so this poor Austrian economy minister has said that the agency overseeing the sale was not aware of the inscription and the sale was legal because they wanted. Now, some of them want to say that the sale can't go through because the government selling the bell. Here's the thing. The fact that the Austrian government has sold this bell with Hitler's name on it might be a criminal offense because it could be used to, quote, spread Nazi ideology. You see how crazy they go there? Now, these are the Jews. And but this Austrian minister is saying, well, you know, we didn't know. So since we were not aware of that, the sale is legal. They don't want to have their sale, you know, not be valid. But these people do nothing but stir up trouble. These crummy Jews. Crummy, crummy Jews. What else can you say about them? Is anybody doing that to them? Are other people going around looking for every single thing they do and accusing them and saying, oh, you know, we can't have this, we can't have that? No, because they have the media and the public public correctness on their side. But this just irritated me so much. And then I just saw a story, which is not all that important, but I'm going to comment on it. That because it's about Hungary, and I like what's going on in Hungary, and this is the party of the president Viktor Orban, his party, the Fidesz party, not like the Jobbik party. They're not nearly as good as the Jobbik party, but they're a lot bigger. And they are the ruling party now, and yet they're pretty nice, you know. They try to do the right thing. Anyway, they are simply participating. This party, Fidesz party, is simply participating in a what do they call it? Some kind of a festival in Slovakia about the Hungarians in Slovakia, it seems to be. It says the MKP, an ethnic Hungarian party in Slovakia, hosted this event in Slovakia, and it was co-organized by the Fidesz Youth Organization and an association of young Christian Democrats. And at this, they have talks and whatever, you know, going on there. It's just one of those deals. And the Jewish Telegraph Agency has got a story. They're complaining that they have anti-Semitic literature on display at this festival in Slovakia, and they named three books. Ha! Henry Ford's The International Jew. Hooray! The Protocols of the Elders of Zion, and a book that I can't pronounce the title of, which is described as an anti-Semitic book on the Freemasons, or anyway, it's on the Freemasons. It has a Hungarian name. And because they have these books, you know, they think, I guess, that this festival should be closed down or something. And you know, anyway, they might want to make, want the State Department to look into it. Huh! Oh, and they're saying, you know, that using this as an example of, why Prime Minister Viktor Orban needs to be, you know, needs to be condemned, and he needs to be given a lecture to, and he needs to change his ways and so on. That the and they particularly are don't like the Jobbik Party, and Orban has come out and denounced the anti-Semitism in the Jobbik Party. But he didn't do it forcefully enough for these people, so they're saying he, you know, he hasn't really put his heart into that at all, which he doesn't, which is why I like him. So this is you know the kind of thing that is that goes on. Let me see, I'm looking at my let me refresh my mailbox. No, some junk in there, So now I want to go on to talk some about the International Jew. I've gotten more and more impressed as Hadding Scott and I read this on Thursday nights, and we're already into chapter coming up to chapter 58, or no, wait a minute, 53 maybe is episode 58, but. And we're into the book three. There's four volumes, and we're into volume three. But I saw an article. Every month in the First Freedom magazine newspaper that Olaf Childress puts out, he prints a chapter from the International Jew. And I was reading those before we started our program, and that's when I was saying, "Gee, this stuff is so good." You know, Tan and I talked about doing a show just reading it. And that is what we're doing now. And, it gets better and better, you know, and sometimes they say things they say it so well. And I think you could just take that one sentence and use it as a motto or some kind of a propaganda sentence or some kind of a, you know, I'm not thinking of the right word, but a way of just a standalone statement that should be repeated again and again and again and again, because I'm always thinking about how to reach people. The idea of the International Jew is the perfect wording, the perfect idea. And in this one that was in the July issue of the First Freedom, I was looking for it, but it doesn't come up. Actually, in the volumes of the International Jew, they're not in chronological order as they were written in the Dearborn Independent. I thought they were, but they're not, because I was looking for this one, which is July 23rd, 1921, where I thought it would be, and I couldn't find it. And finally, I thought, gee, it's not even in here. But there it was, then way at the end. It's way toward the end in the... maybe in volume three or in volume four, I'm not sure, but it's, I didn't check that out, but it's, Hattie and I won't come up to it for quite a while. So there were some things in there I wanted to talk about, and I don't get a chance, you know, when we're doing the program, we decided to just take 1 hour for it, and we have to read the chapter and, you know, make a few comments, but there's not time to go into it real deeply, and I want to go into this a little bit more, and it'll be quite a while before we get to it, so it's okay. And this one, as I said, it's something about I threw away. Oh, here it is. The title of the chapter is Economic Plans of International Jews. Well, it's pretty basic, but it has some stuff in there like, this is the first sentence of this chapter. The strength of Jewish money is in its internationalism. Well, there you go. You see, right there. This is a great statement. The strength of Jewish money is in its internationalism. Everything about Jews is international. And that's the thing that we have to remember. We're so used to hearing that. Well, I guess I should speak for myself, but I'm so used to hearing, you know, being familiar with the name of the book, The International Jew, and, you know, it's mentioned so much. You get used to it and don't really, think about it, but that is a key thing there. And actually when, on Saturday with Andres, on the last Saturday's program, we got into this a bit. You know, internationalism is opposed to nationalism. Nationalism is, well, naturally it is. I was thinking also democracy, but naturally nationalism is, not the same as the opposite of internationalism. But, the strength of Jewish money is in its internationalism. Here's another good part to it. In 1921, I said that, you know, it was never, let's remember, this was written in 1921. Now that's almost 100 years ago. And they had everything understood then. And here we are 100 years later, and we haven't made any progress. In fact, we've gone back, you know, it's gotten worse. So there's something that our people are not getting, are not able to get, are not willing to get, and so on. And maybe, you know, I keep thinking of how we can make it simpler, plainer, clearer, and try to get people to understand this. Because the International Jew wrote, "The gold, which is their God, who they call the God of the living." That's what they say the Jews call their gold, the God of the living. That might be from the protocols, for all I know, is being brought overseas on every available ship and locked up in vaults of Jewish bankers in North and South America. You see, in 1921, this was written that they were bringing their gold over to North and South America from Europe and from the capitals there and locking it up in their vaults. And what they're implying to me, I think, is because they were planning they say they are nervous. They were nervous about what was going on, but that's because at that time, fascism was rising and, people were, unhappy because of World War I, and they realized the part that the Jews played in that. And the Jews were getting nervous, but I also, and the International Jew has said this many times, the Jews were planning the coming Second War in Europe. And, they were getting ready for it because they didn't know how exactly it would go. And they're getting all their gold out of Europe and into, North and South America. And, then it goes, another part of it says the Rothschilds were never bankers in a proper sense. They were money lenders to nations whose representatives they had corrupted to seek the loans. They did business precisely on the plane of the money lender in the side street who induces the rich man's son to borrow a large sum knowing that the father will pay. That is scarcely banking. So the Rothschilds, you know, they say banking is a real banking is where you take deposit money, you know, money from your customers. They deposit their money in your bank. You hold it there. You guarantee them to be able to get it back out again. And, now you, not anymore, not lately, but you should get paid a little interest on it. And they are able to use your money to invest things, but good bankers are conservative. And, you know, they don't take chances with it, and they, you know, and it usually worked out pretty well. People were kind of happy, pretty happy to be able to put their excess money in a bank and for when until they needed it for something, and it was very, very unlikely that you wouldn't be able to get it back again. You did, you were able to, so it worked out. But he's saying that the the Jewish banking and the Rothschilds were not bankers like that. They were money lenders. Their whole idea of what they were doing was to lend money and to loan money out to people and get back a lot of interest, and also to then confiscate their property when they couldn't pay back when they couldn't pay the interest on their loans or nowadays a lot of it is people buying homes or buying property of one kind, and if they can't keep paying for it because they borrowed the money to buy it, then they can come and take it back. So this is what happens when you have a crash or a big what's called a panic, and this is what they're all about. And this is, they say also that they do it in such a way that they try to get people to borrow money who aren't very responsible, and then knowing that somebody else who stands behind them will pay. So I guess if you're loaning money to governments, and you have some irresponsible people in the government who are running up a bill like that, still, if they run into trouble, they know that somehow that government will pay. That somehow they will get it, and that they say that's not banking. That's like the money lenders in the side street. You know, that's the kind of mentality that they have. And it's not, therefore, the success of the individual Jewish banking house that concerns us, they say. We are, you know, it's like if they say it's not that you fear Jewish bankers, you know, one bank or, you know, one Jewish business or another. Because the problem is we're dealing with a world chain of financial consulates, all of them linking up in a world system, none of them to be regarded as American or British or French or Italian or German, but all of them as members of the Jewish world banking system. Well, they didn't have any problem saying this in 1921. It's true, it wasn't supposed to be said, just like today, because the Dearborn Independent was writing this stuff, and the Jews were complaining all the time about it, and others were going along with them, and saying that they were writing scurrilous things, but they stood behind it. Now, the whole thing here that to remember is that, again, we're dealing with this world organization. We're not dealing with individuals. We're not dealing with what we're used to with other people. We're dealing with international system, international cooperation amongst all these individual Jews. And therefore, we're dealing really with an international conspiracy. You can't not call it that. Particularly when you come up to the idea, to the fact that they were behind the wars. And the international Jew also doesn't back down on that. So going on, they say, it's not the wealth and importance of a single house, a single banking house, that makes the Jews be the force that they are. But it's the wealth and importance of the world chain that gives the strength. And they mentioned Kuhn, Loeb & Company as being the most important financial house in the United States. But with its foreign connections, Kuhn, Loeb & Company is far from being the most important financial house in the United States. We hear about that banking company all the time. It's really not banking, but we hear about them, but they were not. There are a lot of, and still are, a lot of Gentile bankers and a lot of with lots of money, lots of Gentiles with lots of money. But what they are is that they don't have this connected, international connected. They're not part of an international connected group like the Jews are. So the whole difference is not in how many billionaires there are, how many millionaires, you know, among this or that group. It's the way the Jews operate. And Kuhn Loeb is not the most important financial house in the United States, but with its foreign connections, all of which are Jewish, it takes on a new aspect. And it turns out that it was an idea that came out of Kuhn Loeb and Company's office that now dominates the monetary system of the United States. They're probably talking about the Federal Reserve, but they don't say so in this particular article. But it's probably what they're talking about. That's where it originated, the idea of the Federal Reserve. And the United States, they say Paul Warburg, a German Jew, you know, he is a Jew who lived in Germany and came from Germany, is boosted into undue prominence and power, which he never otherwise would have had because of his connections. Because, you know, all Jewish ones, because of his connection within this Jewish international framework that they all go along, they all cooperate in. Excuse me. And then now here's where they say Jewish bankers ran this war as they have run every great war. They mean World War I. Jewish bankers ran this war as they have run every great war. Now that's shades of Mel Gibson, right? You know, Mel Gibson said that and got in all that trouble. But they're saying it. Of course, they're not, you know, the international Jew is not very well respected in politically correct society. But this is what they say. They don't mess around with it. And we should be saying this. We should be saying this. And if people say, oh, that's this or that, then you can talk to them about why it's true. But you have to know something about it. Now, they say no informed Jew will deny that. Most informed Jews have boasted of it as indicating the importance of their people. And they say above the nations at war was an international financial committee, all Jewish, looking serenely down upon all the ruction and blood. You know, as it would think about World War I. Think about what happened. Think about all of that death and destruction and all those young men, you know, fighting away and dying and suffering and having limbs blown off and being, you know, being maimed and all that took place all those years, 4 years. And these Jews are financing it all and watching it without it troubling them. Is not affecting them. And how many Jews were involved in any of that fighting? No, they had their Jews who were responsive to this international conspiracy, working to gain more power and influence in these nations, and making money off the war too, making a lot of money off the war, working on the home front. So if this could get, you know, if we could get the American people, or people everywhere, but you know, European people, to accept this, to understand this, to know that this was happening, how angry they would be. I think they would be. You never know, since it was a while ago, since it was a long time ago, and a lot of people today, World War I is like, you know, prehistory to them. It doesn't mean a thing to them. But so maybe it's not that effective. It seems effective to me when you think about if. But you have to be convinced that this is the way it was actually happening. The chapter goes on to say, separated, each man tied to his country by ties of undivided nationalistic loyalty. You know, once again, none of these men would have amounted to much. You know, as separate beings, none of these people were all that great. You know, they could not have made any of these things happen. But as a supranational financial board, supranational, knowing the secrets of all the nations, which they did, and conferring with one another in all sorts of ways, and then they say deciding the duration of the war and the hour of so-called peace, they accuse this Jewish international group and these Jewish bankers of deciding how long the war would last, and when it would end, and when they would have the so-called peace treaty that they were prepared to go in there and get what they wanted accomplished. And they say, because of this kind of connection, again, once again, their organization, these groups constitute a danger, which no one doubts after having once clearly seen it. Yeah, well, you got to get people to clearly see it. And again, they say the peace treaty, the World War I peace treaty, and there was the Versailles Treaty, there was the... Oh, what were the other two? My poor brain. I can't say what they are. All right, the words won't come to me. But there was the one for Austria and there was the one for Hungary. These peace treaties were written by the financiers, and they call it the bill presented to the world. Not necessarily just to Germany or to Italy or to... not Italy, or to Austria, or to Hungary, but presented to the world, presented basically to Europe. They got what they wanted. Well, we know they got lots of rights. They got their Jewish emancipation, basically, in all of Europe in that peace treaty. And they say here, very few people have ever read it, but its operation is evident everywhere. The Jewish bankers the world over are shoveling in the gold. Well, you know, I have not read the peace treaties. I've read about them, but I haven't read them. And I wonder how many of you have read it. I bet you haven't read it either. And I bet it's not read in university courses. When you have a history course that includes the war, they just would just skim over it. They would not, you know... This is the problem that we have. We don't really read this stuff, and a lot of people are not even, I suppose, capable of understanding it. Other people, it's time. You know, if I come across something like that, I think, I'll try to come back and read this later. I've got too many things I think I need to do to sit and read something that long. But we think about today all of the, what about the Snowden affair and what about this NSA business? How many of us actually read what is available to be read? I don't. So, yeah, that's, but they have read it. They have read all this stuff and they say that it was written basically by the Jews, by the financiers, and it's a bill. It's basically a bill that they presented, that everybody had to pay, and they got what they wanted out of it. And they really have said over and over again that the Jews were responsible for the war, and they decided how long the war would last and when it would end, and they got everything they wanted from it. And they made a bunch of money out of it, too. This kind of shocking stuff somehow needs to be gotten across to people. So then they say, at the present moment, the number of business concerns in the hands of Jewish creditors through loans is very large. The Jewish idea in business is to borrow instead of making the business stand on its own 2 feet. Now, this is another important concept, that the Jewish idea that has infiltrated our entire system, our entire modern way of thinking and modern economics and so on, is that it's smart to borrow money. And you come out ahead that way because you borrow money, and then you can spend money. You can spend this money you borrowed to make more money. You know, you're always going to make more money, and you can pay back what you borrow. You can pay back the interest because you're going to make more than what the interest that you have to pay back is on top of your main loan and so on. And, you know, this came into fashion, I would say, in my lifetime, where in the 70s, it was really going strong. And I was certainly old enough to comment on it. And I didn't like it. And I didn't think it was a good idea. And I never did go into that. I never was a credit card user. I never lived beyond my means. I never could go along with it. But people did. And it appeared that the people who were doing so were really doing well. And sometimes, you know, people were buying houses and, you know, they had these big mortgages, and then they'd sell the house and make a big profit, and then they'd buy another house, or they'd rent, they'd buy some rental properties, and then they'd buy some more, and they're always borrowing, and people had a big, they owed a lot of money. Now today we have these students with their college loans, and they're in debt in, you know, thousands and many. I don't know if they get up to 100,000, any of them, but, you know, $20,000, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 or more, and they have to pay all that back. But they're told that, oh, it's a good idea because they're going to be in a better position than those who didn't do it, because they're going to have this education that's going to make them so much more money. Well, it doesn't always work that way. And then as soon as you as soon as there's a financial quirkiness happening, you know, the rug gets pulled out and you can lose a whole lot. That's what happened in the so-called depression in the 1930s. That really hurt my grandparents. People get caught in that. Even if you're trying to be careful and not going along with the borrowing bit. But this, and then the international Jew says this, that is the idea that extravagance and debt support the Jewish moneylender's power. And this is what is being pushed by in the Jewish, the Judaized consciousness, the Judaized social thinking and so on that we have now, and the Judaized economics, is that, debt. Well, we know debt supports the Jewish moneylenders. Debt is where they make their money, and extravagance on the part of ourselves. It used to be extravagance on the part of kings and dukes and the nobility in Europe. They were encouraged by the Jews around them, and they always ended up somehow, I shouldn't say always, but often they ended up with these Jews in their court. And they listened to them, or Jewish advisors and so on, who appeared to be giving them good advice and seemed to be real smart. But then they would advise them to, you know, to go ahead and be extravagant. And then they would go into a lot of debt, and then something would happen, and they were in huge debt to these Jews, these Jewish financiers, way back then. And nothing has changed. It's the same. So if we're going, you know, if we're living in, boy, in the 70s, 80s, 90s, people were encouraged to live beyond their means, just encouraged to do so. And they were told, and stories were written, and TV shows were done on this, the idea that these people were getting ahead, you know. These people, look what this person did, became a millionaire, look what this person did. They were encouraged to behave this way. And then came the global financial crisis of 2008, which I think, well, I think it was, it may be the, I think that might be the one that the international Jew is looking forward to here in 1921, They write, the Jewish world program is largely dependent on the false economic ideas it can induce the governments and peoples to accept. All right, and this is in the protocols, too, but they say, you know, but we know this from experience. I know it. I can vouch for it. We were encouraged to believe false economic ideas. This is the John Kenneth Galbraith, and this is the ideas about, the economic ideas that became so popular that all the liberal and labor governments and so on were promoting, and that were the most popular, that if you spend money and invest money, you're going to come out ahead. And so, you know, you just keep spending, you just keep investing, and everybody gets wealthier and wealthier. And this was touted as a solid economic idea that had been proven itself in over the years, you know, since the war, since World War II, throughout the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s, you know. But then it started, you know, we started having some trouble. The International Jew says this is not only false, but it's cruelly deceptive and impossible. It's impossible that that these ideas will work. But they're sown among the masses of people. At the same time, they are encouraged in the upper circles of banking and government. So these people are fooled too. A lot of the people who are, they're not all involved in this financial conspiracy, you might say, to make that the Jews are doing in order to enrich themselves. That's why they do it, to enrich themselves and to get more and more control. The more of the money that they are in control of, the more power they have. And so a lot of people in universities and so on, in government, and even in banking, fell for this too. Because it appeared to be working. And it culminated, I'm saying, here's where they say, they are establishing Judah by that falsity, and they will try to maintain that falsity until it brings the inevitable collapse, after which they hope to reorganize the world on Jewish monetary principles. That's what the International Jew wrote in this chapter. They will maintain these false economic ideas until comes the inevitable collapse, and they would mean a big collapse, after which they hope to reorganize the world on Jewish monetary principles. Well, when they're going to be in power and they're going to change the economic principles to suit themselves after they're in power and have control of all the money. Well, I think it's possible that people think that's still coming, that we still have this huge collapse to come, but it may be that we've already collapsed, and this global financial crisis of 2008 was very serious, and we're still suffering from it and probably never will recover. It cost us untold trillions of dollars. Remember those bailout figures. And then it turned out later that was just a drop in the bucket, that what was really happening behind the scenes was, you know, huge amounts of trillion, huge amount. I can't even conceive of the money they're talking about. I just can't. I can't, you know, we're talking about bailing out Greece in the EU for, you know, $6 billion or something. And it sounds like so much. $6 billion, wow. But then I was thinking, after talking with Andre on Saturday, when he said there are about 10 million people in Greece, population. But gosh, and then I read something after that, and it said 10 million Greeks and 3 million foreigners in the country. I thought, 10 million? That's not what a tiny, tiny country. No wonder, why would anybody be so worried about what's happening there? I mean, or how much you have to help them to, so this $6 billion to bail them out must be, is another drop in the bucket, because we're dealing here in the United States with trillions all the time. And we have $350 million people in this country, I think, something like that, unless it's closer to 400 by now, but it's 300 and some million. And they've only got 10 million in Greece. 10 million? We probably have 10 million Greeks living in the United States. That is really small. I was just, you know, just trying to compare these things. Is mind-blowing. So we may, you know, we, this collapse that we're in, you know, the United States is currently, I wonder if I have something here about that. Maybe I do. The United States is currently just about, you know, broke and all of that stuff. So we're all, and we're totally under the Jewish system. Well, let me go on here. I might be getting to that. The present Jewish system, it says in the International Jew, is focused on ways and means to make the lower classes hate the well-to-do. So this, you know, we're focused now on money, and there's a lot of that going on, that, well, we need to support the working class. These plutocrats are all a bunch of, you know, even the white ones. It's not just the Jews. It's all their wealthy people. It's all these corporate people. They're all bad. I don't go along with that. I understand there's, you know, what they're saying, but I don't go along with it. And I don't think that the working class people are better than wealthy people, because if they had the money, they would be just as bad or worse. You know, it's only because they don't have. And so I don't, you know, that's not how you judge the quality of people. So I think, I think Hitler realized after a time that he was much more of a socialist when he began his career in the early 20s than he was in later on. And he realized that you had to have a country of based on your racial, ethnic people, and they had to all get along, and they had to all play their part, because everybody, you know, all levels were necessary. You couldn't just have a working class country, you just have working class people. You needed all kinds of, you know, needed other types of people. Of course, I don't need to go through it all. You all understand that. So, but this is what the Jewish world. Okay, the international Jewish organizations, that's what they're going about it, to make the lower classes hate the well-to-do. And that's how every revolution was dealt with, was fought with, to turn one part of the country against the other and tear the country apart. And it's easy to fall into this. It's easy to get mad in our country, say, in the United States, and to get mad, certainly get mad at the government and want to pull it down and tear it down. And well, I think our government is rotten, but it's not, and it's added so many laws and does so much that it shouldn't be, you know, that should be destroyed. But you have to be careful what you're doing, because this is what the Jews want, this to happen, and they come out ahead when this big struggle or revolutions take place. So, you know, I'd say you always have the rich among you, and you always have the poor among you. That's always been said, it's always been true, and it will always be true. There's no, you don't have equality, because some people move ahead and others don't quite in that way. Anyway, to go on, talking about the money sharks, so they put it that it's not, for the Jews, it's not a matter of making money. Jews are not about making money. They're about getting money. And, you know, they try to figure out how they can get it, not how they can make it. And panics are more quickly profitable then it's a long period of prosperity, they say. Long periods of prosperity are good for everyone, but that doesn't make the kind of money that Jews want to make for themselves. So they want to create artificial prosperity where people are borrowing a lot, and in order to do business and, you know, buy property, or, you know, because everything is going up, 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 and then pull the rug out and then have a panic, and then they go and reclaim all that stuff, and they're the ones who come out ahead. They're behind all that. So it says the men who deal in money as a commodity and on the Jewish plan lose their prestige if prosperity continues too long. So you see, they have a totally different attitude toward it. It says, well, here's where they say it, right here in 1921. That's where I just had just read this. Okay. They say, as operating groups, the governments are bankrupt now. Only their power of confiscation keeps them up. The United States, commonly referred to as the richest country in the world, is just as poor as a government as any other. It has nothing. It is in debt and borrowing. So in 1921, they already, well, they was, of course, it was after World War One, but they are saying that the United States is not rich. It's poor. It has nothing. It's in debt and it's borrowing. And of course, we've increased that. We're in that in peacetime now. But we've had all these wars in order to keep us, to put us in that state, in a wartime poverty, spending all our money. And who's been behind all those wars? The Jews. All these wars we've been in, from Vietnam to Afghanistan, Iraq, and now just all over the place, you know, little things. Well, they say here at the end, even the Liberty Bonds are almost passed out of the hands of the people into the hands of Jewish fiscal agents who get money out of the necessities of the people who sell and out of the necessities of the government which borrowed. Well, I figure that this means they're getting money from the people who find it necessary to sell what they have. And the government finds it necessary to borrow money. And in all those ways, the Jews are the ones who are the agents of all this. And they're the ones who get money from this. They don't earn it. They don't make it. What was the other word that was used? They don't make money. They just get your money. They get other people's money. I think that's what they mean. Making money is something that someone like Henry Ford did, because he had that great business, and he invented this things about the automobile, and then he produced these automobiles, and he was increasing the wealth of the country and the people, and including himself. He became so wealthy, but he was increasing wealth for everybody. But the Jews don't do that. They're not making money. They're getting hold of money. That's great just in itself. And here's the last sentence that I wanted to say that I think is very good. The amount of our national debt is the measure of our enslavement to Jewish world finance. Well, they wrote this, you see. This article is dated July 23rd, 1921. The amount of our national debt is the measure of our enslavement to Jewish world finance. Well, our national debt has never been greater. And we all know that our enslavement to Jewish world finance and Jewish world everything, Jewish everything, has never been greater. So this is where we stand. And I just wish that we could get this across to more people to understand, because it's really hard to get people to talk about the Jews. I know that, and people want to not even talk about them because it's so hard to talk about them. Let's see what else I've got here in the last minutes or so. Had a bunch of stories, but it's not all that important to speak about. Let's see, what have I got? 4 minutes, okay. 3 minutes, maybe. You know, this story about this Castro, Ariel Castro, he finally, you know, he's the guy who held those three women hostage in his house for 20 years or something, and they never got out. It was horrible. A couple of them had kids. He had sex with them, and they had to live in these prison-like conditions. He's from Puerto Rico. And he's not. His father moved to the United States from Puerto Rico in 1954. He's Puerto Rican. He's 52 years old. He was when he was arrested. And things about him, he is one of nine siblings, okay, came from a big family. But his family doesn't seem to be bad. That's, you know, you can't blame the Puerto Ricans because the family doesn't seem to be that bad. But he had this common law wife. He beat her up. She finally got away, and he went after her even after she got away. But he finally gave up on her, I guess. And he had this home. It was his house. And then he, you know, found these women and hid them in there. And what he had done to his common law wife, he had beat her up, broke her nose, her ribs and arms, and once threw her down a set of stairs, cracking her skull. And what happened to him? Nothing. He was, you know, somebody should have done something about that man all along. His family should have done something about him. His family, you know, these people who come from these foreign places, and they have these horrible ways of life and way of treating people. And, you know, there are a lot of signs about this man. And nothing happens to him until he's finally, you know, done all of this. And now they're going to put him in prison for life. He's probably 53. He'll probably live a long life because, you know, he'll be taken well care of in prison. There's nothing wrong with him. He'll probably live a long life. We're going to be paying the bill for this no good piece of garbage all these years when he should have been put to death for what he did. This is just another thing to complain about. But the time is up, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining me tonight on this kind of different Heretics Hour program. And be sure to return to the White Network for and tomorrow night, Tan's program. And don't miss that. Good night.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.